We've got 32 minutes to cover 66 chapters. Well, that's all the time I've got is one night to cover this book. And I'm down to 32 minutes. This ain't going to happen, but we're going to try. The book of Isaiah. What do you know about it? Here's a book. Look at Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 1. We know that it's written by a man by the name of Isaiah, the son of Amoz. And there's not a great deal that we know about the man, but we do know that he was one of the premier prophets, at least is the way we view it. One, because he's the first of the major prophets. And so we look at him through a different light than we would even some of the minor prophets. We also see him through a particular light because we call Isaiah the messianic prophet. Isaiah talks about Jesus, talks about the Messiah all through his book. And if you want to read some of those prophecies, some of the 332 prophecies, pick up the book of Isaiah and see how many times you read about Jesus in that book. In chapter 1, verse 1, it says that it's written to Judah and Jerusalem. And so as we've said in our study of the prophets, we need to know if they're talking to the northern kingdom or the southern kingdom. Isaiah is talking to the southern kingdom. And he's a contemporary, I think this is down in the next part, he's a contemporary with Micah. When we studied Micah, we said that Micah was kind of out in the countryside of Judah, whereas Isaiah was there in Jerusalem, and he had the ear of the kings and the priests and some of those kind of folks. So he's kind of the statesman prophet. But it's written to these Jews down in the southern kingdom, written to them because they had become a very proud people, which I hope we have time to talk about here in a couple minutes. But they had become a very proud people. They had turned their backs on God. And instead of trusting in God, they were beginning to trust even in their enemies who were surrounding them. And especially in Assyria. Isaiah prophesied, we usually put it about 750 B.C. It's really the latter part of the 8th century B.C. And this is a period of time, obviously, of the divided kingdom. About 200 years after the period of David and Solomon. It's only about, depending on when the prophecy took place, it's only a couple years, a matter of years, before the northern kingdom fell. Why did Israel fall to Assyria? What was their basic problem that God allowed Assyria to take them? Idolatry. God's people had begun worshiping idols. And so Isaiah has some things to say about and even to Israel, the northern kingdom in this book, but it's primarily to Judah. And because Judah heeded some of the things that Isaiah prophesied about, they lasted a little longer than the southern kingdom. But as you look at, look in chapter 1, verse 1, he prophesied during the days of Uzziah. Uzziah had some good days, righteous days at the beginning of his reign, but then he turned wicked. Jotham, Ahaz, wicked kings, Hezekiah. Those are the four kings that he prophesied under. Hezekiah, is he a good king, or righteous king, or an unrighteous king? He's a good king. Hezekiah came to the throne and began making several reforms and tearing down a lot of the idolatry that his predecessors who allowed to come into the nation. So that allowed the nation to survive a little bit longer. But eventually, even the southern kingdom was taken captive by the Babylonians. All right, some things, we're going to have several things about the introduction here. The main, if you want a key word for the study of the book of Isaiah, what it's all about, it's about salvation. And we don't think about, when we think Old Testament books, we don't think salvation sometimes. We think, okay, New Testament books, and we think about God's plan of salvation in the New Testament and sending Jesus. But here's an Old Testament book who has as its very focus salvation. The salvation of God's people, of that southern kingdom then, and ultimately, we call him the messianic prophet, of the salvation of mankind down through the lineage of David. How northern kingdom was taken captive by Assyria, right? Southern kingdom taken captive by Babylon. Were they totally wiped out, destroyed, everybody killed? How do you know? What did God promise to Abraham? Through your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. What did God promise to David? That I will establish your throne, your descendants, your seed will be on your throne forever. If Babylon took them away and totally destroyed them and wiped them off the face of the earth, what would have happened to God's promise? Boy, that'd be tough to fulfill if everybody's dead. But there was a remnant that was going to survive and come out of that captivity. So here's a message about salvation. What does the name Isaiah mean? What does his name mean? His name means salvation is of the Lord. So God chose a prophet to deliver a message of salvation, and his very name meant salvation. Isaiah had two sons. I'm sorry that Kayla didn't have a son. She could have used one of these names, I'm sure. I mean, Sophia, that's kind of a common name, but if it was a boy, she could have named him Sher Jashub. Do you know anybody by that name? Nobody else would have it. Or you could name your next grandchild Mahershal Hashbaz. It's in today to give your child a hyphenated name, isn't it? There you go. What does that got? Three hyphens in it, right? So, but the very two sons and the names of his sons are indicative of the entire story and the entire account that we read in the book of Isaiah. His name means salvation is of the Lord. His first son that we read about in chapter 7, I don't think I've got the chapters up here, but we read about him in chapter 7, Sher Jashub, his name means a remnant will return. So God's people are going into captivity, but Isaiah has a son, and by his very name it means there's a remnant that's going to come out. And then he has the second son in chapter 8, Mahershal Hashbaz. We're going to have a spelling test at the end of class tonight, so write that one down. Whose name means the booty or the spoils of the war, they come quickly. And so you've got both aspects of that there's war and there's spoils that are going to come from this war and there's going to be strife, but there's going to be a remnant that survives. The very emphasis of this entire book is the matter of salvation. I wish we had time to look at Isaiah's vision in chapter 6, but I feel like that's maybe a part of this book that you know, and I'm just going to skip right over that. Okay, maybe you've heard the book of Isaiah called a miniature Bible. Anybody ever heard the book of Isaiah called a miniature Bible? Joe is the only one. How did I figure that one? How many books are in the Bible? 66. How many chapters are in Isaiah? Name one other book in the Bible that has 66 chapters total. You can't think of another one, can you? Nope, not one. There's 150 Psalms, and then you go down to 66 in Isaiah. Not another one. The Old Testament has what? 39 books. New Testament has 27 books. If you were to divide the book of Isaiah into two parts, it would be the first 39 chapters, and it would be the last 27 chapters. So there again, it's like a little Bible. The first 39 chapters talk about man's condition and how hopeless it is and how he cannot save himself apart from God. That sounds like the Old Testament, doesn't it? The last 27 chapters talk about the promise of God and talk about the Savior that's coming and talk about the salvation that God is going to save his people out of Babylon, but ultimately he's going to save his people by Jesus. That sounds like the New Testament, doesn't it? Little miniature Bible that who's the messianic prophet? Who talks about Jesus more than anybody else in the Old Testament? Isaiah. What does the New Testament talk about? Jesus. The whole thing, the comparisons could probably go on and on, but it's an interesting thing to do. The book of Isaiah is referenced more times in the New Testament. The book of Isaiah is referenced more times in the New Testament than any other book of the Old Testament, save the book of Psalms. All right, last part of introduction, then we're going to look at three things that are emphasized in this book. 39 and 27, but you could take the 39 and divide it into two other sections here, and that's all this is showing, is that the first part, that first division, is very prophetic. And it talks about not only judgments that God was going to bring against his own people, but judgments that God was going to bring upon other nations. And then you've got a section there from about chapter 35 to 39 that talks about the King Hezekiah. And when you read chapters 35 to 39, you'll recognize a lot of similarities between that and what you read about Hezekiah over in 2 Kings. Very similar wording in a lot of cases. But the reign of Hezekiah, remember he's one of the four kings that Isaiah prophesied under. The reign of Hezekiah was critical to the time and the prophecies of Isaiah. Because Isaiah is prophesying to Judah that they need to turn around. The northern kingdom of Israel was being taken away captive by Assyria. That should have been a warning, shouldn't it? I mean, if you see your brethren, you know, taken captive, wouldn't you say, what did they do? What should we change so that that doesn't happen to us? Wouldn't that be a good thing to think about? And so here's Isaiah saying, hey, Judah, you all need to turn around. You need to change what you're doing. Here comes King Hezekiah, and King Hezekiah actually listens. Because Uzziah and Jotham and Ahaz, they didn't listen to Isaiah. Isaiah had opportunity to preach, but they weren't willing to listen. So Assyria comes and takes the northern kingdom. Well, were they done? Once Assyria took the northern kingdom, did they say, oh, that's enough, we'll just go back home. We don't need to go any further. You know any world dominators that think, oh, that's enough? No, they weren't done. So Assyria started to come down into the southern kingdom. In fact, Assyria had already conquered, I don't remember how many, it's like 40-something cities in the southern kingdom. And now they have besieged the city of Jerusalem. Here's Assyria. They have surrounded Jerusalem. Well, what are they going to do? What's Judah going to do? Here's what they thought about doing. They thought about allying themselves with Egypt. Let's see. Here's some bad guys from Assyria. How can we beat them? Oh, we can't beat them by ourselves. Forgot that God was their commander-in-chief. We can't beat them by ourselves, so we'll go make friends with the Egyptians. Yeah, that would have been brilliant, right? Because the Egyptians, they serve God, right? And they're godly people, right? And they won't get you off track on where you're supposed to go spiritually, would they? So they thought about doing that, and Isaiah spends several chapters in the middle of his book telling them, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. Well, what they ended up doing instead is they made an alliance with Assyria. If you can't beat them, join them. All right, good. All right, so don't hurt us. If you won't hurt us, then we will pay tribute to you and we will be nice to you and do whatever you say. It's basically what happened. Can you believe God's people would do that? So they basically form an alliance with Assyria. So you think that impacted Judah's religion at all? Where did you think idolatry came from? Here comes Assyria. They didn't serve God. Here's this pagan nation. And they've come and they have now taken up residence. And now Judah is paying tribute to Assyria. And then here comes King Hezekiah. King Hezekiah says, this is enough. We're not doing this. So the fact that there's a little historical setting right there in the middle of the book is significant. And then you get those last 27 chapters that are very prophetic and they're very messianic. Very briefly, what do I got now? 17 minutes. There's three what I see as major themes that run throughout the book of Isaiah. We're not going to have time to develop all of these individually. But when you read the 66 chapters of Isaiah, it's incredible the picture that you have of God as you read through it. One of the repeated phrases and repeated words throughout the book is talking about the righteousness and the justice of God. Those two words are tied together, 20-something times, I think, in the book, where it talks about the righteousness of God, and then right beside it, it talks about his justice. What happens if we do not submit ourselves unto the righteousness of God? What's going to come upon us? The justice of God. They're tied together. And so God is a righteous God, and He is a just God, and He expects His people to follow His righteousness and to submit unto His justice. And then in that great story in chapter 6, we get a picture of the glory of God like no other place in the Bible. And here, look in chapter 6 just briefly. You know this story, I hope. When Isaiah sees this vision in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up. The train of His robe filled the temple. Above it stood seraphim. Each one had 6 wings. 2 covered His face, 2 covered His feet, and with 2 He flew. One cried to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory." And the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of Him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. So I said, "Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." And one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a live coal, which he had taken with tongs from the altar, and he touched my mouth with it. And he said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is purged." You see a picture of the throne room of God, of the glory of God, filling the throne room of God. And Isaiah is overwhelmed by what he sees, by the glory of God. And he says, "I don't belong here. Woe is me, I'm undone, I've got unclean lips. I don't belong in this place." Isaiah got to see the glory of the Lord. And what was his response to the glory of the Lord? "God, you need somebody? I'm your man. Don't look any further," because God was looking. Verse 8, "I heard a voice, 'Whom shall I send and who will go for us?'" God's looking around the throne room of heaven, and here's the guy who feels like he's not even worthy to be there, and he says, "God, that'll be me. You don't need to look anywhere else." We see a picture of the glory of God, but one of the main things that we see throughout this book about God is His holiness. 25 times in this book, He's called the Holy One of Israel. And you only have 6 other times in the entire New Testament where He's called that. The Holy One of Israel. Why do you think that's emphasized throughout this book? Think about what was happening in Israel, what was happening in Judah. Why would it be important to emphasize the holiness of God? Say again. They had forgotten that God is holy. What does that mean? What does the holiness of God mean? What is that talking about? Anybody else like Him? Is He set apart? Is He high and lifted up? Go to chapter 40. I want to look at this passage in chapter 40. Look at Isaiah chapter 40. Look at what it says about, look at what it says about God. Let's drop down and start in verse 18. We don't have time to look at all of that, but look in verse 18. Isaiah 40, verse 18. "To whom then will you liken God?" I want you to think about that question. Who would you compare God to? To whom would you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare to Him? "The workman molds an image, an idol. The goldsmith overspreads it with gold." Get the picture. He has cut this image out. Now the goldsmith lays it with gold. The silversmith casts silver chains. "Whoever is too impoverished for such a contribution chooses a tree that will not rot. He seeks for himself a skillful workman to prepare a carved image that will not totter. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is He who sits on the sphere of the earth." Is the world flat? No. Isaiah knew that. "And its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens." This is what God does. Stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth useless. Who's in control? Sometimes man thinks he is. Sometimes princes and judges think they are. Verse 25, "To whom then will you liken me? Or to whom shall I be equal, says the Holy One?" Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things. Was it your idol? Was it that image that you carved out of wood? Who brings out their host by number? He calls them all by name, the stars, by the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one is missing. Is there anyone else like God? You know, you think about those closing chapters of the book of Job, where God inquires of Job, all of those things about, Job, where were you when this happened? Where were you when this happened? And do you know about this? And do you know about that? Look in chapter 46. Look in chapter 46 and verse 5, where he asks the same question again. To whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we should be alike? Who were the Israelites worshiping? Idols. If they're worshiping idols, are they in effect saying, I can either worship Jehovah or I can worship this idol and it's all the same? I mean, it's just, this is a god, this is a, it's just all the same. Isn't that what they, in effect, that's what they're saying, isn't it? And God says, excuse me, you're saying that I'm equal to that, or you're saying that that thing is equal to me? Look in verse 6. They lavish gold out of the bag. They will weigh silver on the scales. They hire a silversmith and he makes it. What does the silversmith do? He makes it a what? Wait, where did this God come from? Oh, yeah. He cut it out and the silversmith made it a god. And then what do the people do? After the silversmith has made this god, what do the people do? They prostrate themselves. They fall down before a rock, a piece of wood. Yes, they worship. Then what do? They bear it on the shoulder. What are they doing? They carry it, is what he says. And they set it in its place, and it stands. Oh, isn't that nice? They put their god over there. How did he get there? Oh, they had to carry him because he couldn't get there by himself. And then they put their god over there, and what does he do when they stand him up? Oh, he just stands there. That's nice. From its place, it shall not move. Why not? Isn't he going to get hungry, tired, bored? He's not going to move. Though one cries out to it and prays to it and falls down before it and prostrates before it. Is this rock going to answer him? Though one falls down before it, yet it cannot answer nor save him out of his trouble. Remember this and show yourselves men. Recall to mind, O you transgressors. God's people had turned their back on God. If you turn your back on God, where can you go? What other options do you have? God is holy. There is no other God. There's not just not another God like him. There is no other God. And he's trying to impress upon them that there are consequences for what you're doing. Isaiah is the book that tells us in Isaiah chapter 59 and verse 2 that our sins separate us from God. Judah was going down a path that was separating them from their God. One other thing about the character of God that's seen throughout this book, and I'm just going to throw this up here real quick, and then we're going to go on to the second point, is that you see the sovereignty of God. Who's in charge? In chapter 10, it's interesting to see that who does God use to bring judgment on the northern kingdom? Assyria. Why? Is it because Assyria is more righteous than the northern kingdom? Because they're better and God likes them more? No. God's people in the northern kingdom must be punished for their disobedience and their idolatry, so he uses, who's in control of the world? Who is it who rules? Who is it who gives princes and judges and kings and presidents their authority? God. So he's the one who rules over all, and so he uses a pagan nation to punish even his own people. Well, does that mean that he's not ever going to do anything to that pagan nation then? No. Read the rest of chapter 10. where God says that he's going to raise up another nation that's going to go and to conquer that nation that destroyed his nation. Why? Because their sins have to be punished too. The sovereignty of God is seen in this book, and not the sovereignty of man. Amen. And not the sovereignty of man's ideas and man's wishes. It's God, and it's Daniel who tells us, but we see it throughout this book as well, God rules in the affairs of men. And sometimes we forget that. All right, very briefly, we've looked at the character of God in this book. Look at the character of Judah. Or we could just say the character of man in general. Look in chapter 1. We're going to see about 4 points here real quick in chapter 1. How is Judah described here in just the very first chapter? Verse 2. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth. Isaiah 1 and verse 2. For the Lord has spoken. Here's what God said. The first thing that God said. What's the first thing when you write a letter to somebody, even if you're a little upset? Hey, how you doing? Everything here is good. You know, we did this the other day and we went over here. And, you know, I hope everything's well with your family. You know, you kind of break the ice, right? First thing God says, I have nourished and brought up children. Yes. And what did they do? And they've rebelled against me. Right out of the starting blocks, God says, guys, I'm the one who's brought you to where you are, and you have rebelled against me. Alas, verse 4, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a brood of evildoers, children who are corrupt. I mean, he could have just used one of those phrases, couldn't he? He could have just said one of those things. Okay, I got it. But over and over, they have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked to anger the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away backward. What's wrong with these people? They're rebellious. They have rebelled against God. What else is wrong with these people? They're ungrateful. Look at verse 3. The ox knows its owner. The donkey knows its master's crib. At the end of the day, does the ox know who's in charge? The end of the day, does donkey know, okay, I'm going to go over there and that's where I live because that's where my master's... How smart is a donkey? How smart is an ox? Not the brightest creatures, right? I mean, they could surely go out and get a better job if they were a little bit smarter than having to plow the field. But they're not the brightest creatures, so they got to take the jobs they can get, right? But they know to whom they belong. The end of verse 3, but Israel does not know. Israel does not know what? The ox knows its owner. The donkey knows. Israel's not as smart as an ox and a donkey. Doesn't even know to whom they belong. My people do not consider. They're a rebellious people. They're an ungrateful people. They're a hypocritical people. Look in verse 10. Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Wait. I thought Sodom had been destroyed, hadn't it? I mean, wasn't it in Genesis 18 and 19? Fire and brimstone wiped out, right? So if Sodom's gone, who are the rulers of Sodom? I mean, Sodom doesn't exist anymore. Who's the rulers of Sodom? These people. He has taken the word Judah, that's who they are, and he's taken another word, Sodom, and put it in its place. Hey, rulers of Judah, he could have said. But instead he says, hey, rulers of Sodom. Would that get your attention? If somebody were to take your name out of a sentence and put something else in the sentence that's not so nice, does that get your attention? I mean, if somebody were to say, hey, David, I know they're talking to me, right? But instead, if they were to say, hey, ugly. They're talking to me, but that's not the nicest thing to say, is it? I mean, yes, let's be truthful, but you don't have to always spell it out, right? But if they put another word in there, it really grabs you, doesn't it? Hey, rulers of Sodom. Okay, that's not so good. Give ear to the law of our God, you people of Gomorrah. Who is God comparing them to? Some of the most wicked cities on the face of the earth. To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifice? Why are you offering these sacrifices? As you read through these next several verses, you see how hypocritical God's people had become. And don't try to write this down because I'm fixing to move on. But God's people had become hypocritical. Were they worshiping? Were they bringing their sacrifices and their offerings? Yep, they were doing that. What was wrong? Well, the very thing that Jesus said about the Pharisees came right here from the book of Isaiah. They were drawing near to God with their lips, honoring Him with their mouths, but their heart was not there. Well, they were going to church, and they were going through the motions at church, but the rest of their lives were full of wickedness. They were a bunch of hypocrites. So they are rebellious, they're ungrateful, and they're hypocritical, and they're proud. They are very proud because they've got their military might. And when they don't have their military might, they'll just join forces with Assyria and have all the military might they want. Isaiah is prophesying during a time of prosperity. I mean, they're doing well financially. And when you're doing well financially, you don't have a whole lot of need for God, do you? I'm doing just fine. Got everything I need. Don't really have a need for God. But as you look through the book of Isaiah, over and over, you see their pride talked about. Their lofty looks, their haughtiness, their arrogance of heart, wise in their own eyes. Go when you get home, read chapter 5, verses 20 and 21. They call evil good, and they call good evil. They call light darkness, and darkness light. Something wrong with these people? They call sweet bitter, and bitter sweet. Something wrong with these people. I mean, if I want sweet tea, I want sweet tea, right? But they've totally twisted things. Why? Because they're dumb? No. Well, yes. But not necessarily because they're dumb, but because they think they own the world. And they can just say whatever they want and do whatever they want, and they'll be just fine because they thought, nah, the overflowing scourge of God's punishment is not going to come on us. It'll come on those other people. Mm-mm. God's punishment's going to come on you. All right. This is the part we didn't have time for, but you know that he's the messianic prophet. And so throughout this book, you see Jesus from beginning to end. You see his birth. Jesus would be born of a virgin. He would be called Emmanuel, God with us. He would be called the Wonderful Counselor. Y'all know that from Isaiah 9? Prince of Peace, Everlasting Father, Mighty God, Prince of Peace. You read through this book, you see the King and His kingdom talked about all the way through it. Sometime, sit down over a period of 2 weeks and read through the book of Isaiah. And then when you're done with that 2 weeks, go back for the next 2 weeks and read it again. And then after you've read it twice, take the next 6 months and read through the New Testament and see how many times you can draw lines from the book of Isaiah over to the New Testament. Sometimes Matthew will do it for you, right? This was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet Isaiah saying, and you got, but sometimes it's not always drawing the line. But you can see them the more familiar we become with it, because Isaiah is sometimes called the fifth gospel. Not because it's some different gospel account, but because he's right there with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John talking about Jesus just as much as they did. Okay, sorry I went a little overtime.